This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Hand in hand with FX Guide, our training site FXPhd allows you to do online training with the benefit of industry professionals to guide you. This new April term includes training in Nuke 7, Hero, editing, grading, lens tech, and even maths for VFX. Check it all out at fxphd.com. Welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going to revisit Tony Stark, suited up as he is in Iron Man 3. I'm joined by, well, I'd like to say the guy that actually wrote the book on the Iron Man suit, but actually it's the guy that wrote the story that became the foundation for the Wikipedia entry on the book, Ian Fail. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How are you?
If you look up Iron Man's suit and look up live action films, literally that whole section down the bottom there is all quoted from stuff that Ian has published on Iron Man 3. And, of course, that comes from the story that you steered at fxguide.com. And, of course, you've been in Germany, so you got to hear about this firsthand, right?
Yeah, that's right. When we were at the FMX conference, both Trickster and Weta Digital gave a presentation on Iron Man 3, and the film hadn't actually come out yet. So we basically saw some great breakdowns, so it'd be good to talk about that.
So I'll be sucking that information out of you next. But first I need to speak to my to Matt Wallen, who's an academically made man. Congratulations, Matt.
Oh, thank you very much, yeah.
So you have tenure.
Yeah, so I've been teaching at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, for the past 6 or so years now. And one of the things that you do as an academic, which I never in a million years ever thought I would be an academic, but it's been a heck of a lot of fun. And one of the things you do is you eventually, if you want to sort of go up through the ranks of those kind of institutions, you go up for what's called tenure. And if you get tenure, you basically have, I guess, academic freedom, they say. And I've been joking around telling my friends it's like being a made guy in the academic mafia.
Absolutely. It's a huge honor. Yes. So you are getting there from an interesting route, really, because normally people to get that kind of tenure at an academic institution do a master's or a PhD and then spend a long time at a university and doing research papers and stuff. But, of course, you came from a sort of a very strong practical background as well.
Yeah, so a lot of, not every institution does this, but many institutions will in fields like ours, really, where at least at the time, I think, Mike, you and I at least were probably coming up through the business, there wasn't really a, you know, a master's degree or a PhD degree in, you know, a field related to visual effects. And so I actually only have a bachelor's degree from San Francisco State University, a degree in cinema, so a film school degree. And I got all my real-world experience working in the industry. And so the university and the provost at the university look at that and they say that, oh, that's the equivalency of a master's degree. So, or, you know, essentially a terminal degree in our field, which would be, I guess, a master's or an MS or maybe an MFA. I don't know that there are any universities that currently offer a PhD, certainly in computer science there are PhDs, but I don't know if there are any in, anything related to sort of film or visual effects, certainly not, a scientific PhD, if anything.
Yeah. Well,
so yeah.
Speaking of incredibly smart people, we are joining Tony Stark on his third outing in his own Iron Man franchise, though second after the Iron Man that appeared in the Avengers. And hopefully he's going to be back for more, though there's a lot of publicity around the fact that that's being negotiated. So starting with, should I call you professor now?
No, please call me Matt, yeah.
So, Matt, what did you think of this fourth time we've seen a Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man, the third film?
All right, so I'm going to confess something, and it's going to be a little bit controversial on the show, I think, with you especially, Mike, but I think this is the greatest superhero trilogy.
Holy dooly. That's a big call.
Yeah, and the reason, I mean, the reason is for a couple different reasons. I mean, the first being that I must confess, as a kid, Iron Man was, without a doubt, my favorite comic book. Growing up as, you know, a young kid in Southern California, I loved Iron Man. I always thought he was the coolest because he doesn't really have any special powers, right? He's incredibly wealthy, he's really smart, but he doesn't have any, you know, magical special abilities. He's just uses technology in really interesting ways to basically go out and, you know, fight the bad guys and save the world. But he does so with an air of, you know, incredible style and panache. And I think, you know, this movie, Iron Man 3, I will say I actually really enjoyed it. I was really lucky. I got to go see it with a group, I think, of seven to 12-year-olds, boys, and me went and saw this movie. It was my son's friend's big brother's 12th birthday party, and we went and saw Iron Man 3, and it was awesome seeing it with really the target audience. I totally loved it. I had a great time, and one of the things I think that makes this movie so strong is certainly the visual effects, but I think if you took Robert Downey Jr. out of the role of Tony Stark in Iron Man, I think you would have you wouldn't have the same movie. You would have half the movie. He is such a critical factor in what makes these movies work, because he is, I mean, you know, I confess to having a man crush on Robert Downey Jr. He's awesome. He's so good in the role. He's hilarious. I mean, he's like spot on. It's so good.
I agree. It's a good film, but you really... Because the other candidate that would have to be up against your Iron Man trilogy is another superhero who doesn't have superpowers but has a cape.
I know what you're thinking. Yeah.
Dark Knight. And you would say that the Iron Man trilogy is stronger than the Dark Knight trilogy. You are off your nut. You are completely out to lunch. You have just... walked out the door and closed the door. Now you're a made man. Wow.
No, but think of... But think about this, like, because the reason I would say that, and I knew that this would be controversial, especially with you, but, and probably many people in the audience, but if you think about it, like, I don't know that I see in the Dark Knight trilogy, I don't know that I see a character arc for our main character. Like, he's a singular note character. I think the character himself is not one who... lends himself to any significant kind of change. Like, he is a monotone, essentially, right? And I'm not saying those are bad movies. I enjoy those movies. They're fun to watch. But I don't know that I would go back and watch them again.
I
don't think I would.
Completely. What are you talking about? You are
I think in the end,
Dark Knight Rises again?
And it's so depressing. It's such a downer.
Oh my!
I don't think I would.
Okay, look, just
I don't
just,
know. Just I think I have a strongly.
You have to stop talking now. I'm going to swing in Ian on this before I explode. Oh God, Ian.
Well, Matt, you're not right about it being the best trilogy. Dark Knight
definitely is.
But having said that, the movie is really fun. I actually wanted to pick up something, Matt, you just said about how Robert Downey Jr. and Tony Stark is at the core of the films, and he is in these three in Avengers. But that's kind of the one issue I had with this film. Now that he can, and it's been shown that he can do mirroring with the suits and doesn't even need to be in the suits, that's the only thing that I didn't quite enjoy, I guess, at the end of the film, was where can they go when we actually don't even need Tony in one of the suits? And I wonder if that's going to present a problem for Marvel or the Iron Man franchise in the future.
Okay, we're going to start discussing the visual effects in a second, but let's just clear up a few plot points first, as we always do on the show. So firstly, apart from the metaphor of America's aggression through the use of drones throughout the world and the dehumanization of the military conflict sort of subtext that is in this, can I just get a reading from you, Matt, on how you place Iron Man 3 relative to the other Iron Man films? Is this... I understand how you place the trilogy, but how do you place the third film?
So I'm going to My target demographic audience that I saw the movie with, right, the young men that I went to the cinema with, they afterwards, they had much different feelings about the movie than I did, which I thought was really interesting. They all came out and they said, I said, well, it's pretty good. I would say my take was it was the second best of the three. I enjoyed it more than Iron Man 2. For a couple different reasons, which we can get into if you want, and then, but I still think the first Iron Man is so good in that, you know, it's really Jon Favreau, kind of, you know, at the, you know, working at the top of his game, I think, and really delivering the goods in a really fun, you know, kind of summer blockbuster kind of way. So I would say this is, so maybe I would say I like the first film the best, just because it's, you know, the origin story, and it's kind of, it sets the tone for the whole series. But I thought this one was better than the second one, because I felt like the last film, although it was still fun, for me, it kind of drifted into, you know, other areas that maybe weren't as enjoyable for me in this. And I thought what I really liked about this film, and the boys, of course, that I saw the film with, they all thought that Iron Man 2, the one I liked the least, probably, they all thought that was the best one. So, you know, go figure.
Some teenage girls, and this doesn't even rate because it has no Loki in it. But that's, I think, a slightly different issue.
Interesting. Yeah, now see, that's a different demographic for sure.
Okay, so you.
But I was just going to say,
more than
better than two, but probably not as great as the first one. Only just because I think, you know, the first one, you know, just it just sort of sets the tone for the whole thing. It's sort of like saying, you know, you like Empire Strikes Back better than Star Wars or something. You know, it's sort of like, well, okay,
but likes Empire Strikes Back more than Star Wars, but
sure, but you can't have Empire Strikes Back without having had Star Wars, right? So you kind of pay proper respects to the initial one in the series.
What do you think of the third film, just in terms of its comparison to the other two?
I like this one second as well. I like the first one because I felt like it was so different from a superhero point of view, in that Robert Downey was a bit sort of offhand in a way, and yet you still liked him. And the second one was good, but this one the third one is actually just a lot more fun. I don't know if it has the story that one has, but I just came out of it with, you know, having a lot of fun, really.
So, okay, so just by way of devil's advocate for a second, we will quickly move on to the visual effects, but I have... The first film for me had some problems with the ending. The Iron Giant battle at the end just was kind of like a set piece for me. So I loved the first film, but that particular ending was not particularly great in my opinion. It was good, and it was a good film, and I think it was a remarkable film in the sense that going into it, Iron Man was not a A-list center of sort of superhero universe, and one film with a star that, again, wasn't at the center of the kind of the A-list thing, catapulted the franchise, the film, the character. You know, Robert Downey Jr. now is probably one of the most expensive actors in the world, and it's right because of that character that was set up in the first film and how well that was directed. So I do agree with you. Iron Man 1 was a very important film, good film, and set in chain so many things. And I think, for me personally, I much prefer the Avengers film to Iron Man 3. But I didn't
answer
that question.
That.
But one of the problems I had with Iron Man 3 is just plot-wise, it just seemed to be, you know, I've always liked it when the plots are both respectful to the graphic novel sort of origin stuff, but also just didn't treat the audience as stupid. And this just had too many leaps of like, what the? That seemed to be not so much set pieces, but just odd things that I couldn't forgive them for. I couldn't really get into, just it just seemed daft to me. And I'll just give you a couple of examples before we move on to the visual effects. So the first one is, if you've got an evil guy in an Iron Man, Iron Patriot suit, and he lands right in front of the president, why doesn't he just grab the president and just get out of there? I mean, why does he have to salute him, get on the plane, wait for an hour, and then take the president? It's not as if the taking of the president had to be seen on national television. It was the stringing him up that was meant to be on national television. I just don't see the logic of what they benefited from doing that. It's like, you've got the president, he's right there, just fly, grab him, you're done. Thanks for playing. Secondly, and in the same exact design, if you've got about, you know, 28 suits up your sleeve and the president is in mortal danger, don't catch a boat, you know, just get the suits. And my third one is the suit seemed to be powered not by an arc reactor but by a car battery in that boat, which just was just bizarre. So it was like points in the story that I was like, what? His ability to pull out all those suits. My family have argued with me about this and claiming that he couldn't get access to them until they'd cleared out some of the rubble and stuff. And I'm sure there was some line that indicated that for those that are keeping count. I don't care. It was pretty implausible. So finally, this is probably my biggest criticism, it had a smattering of the Matrix films in the sense that I love the first Matrix film because there was some real danger. But in this one, it got to a point that Tony could leap into any position in the air in any place in the planet and a suit would just magically appear to rescue his sorry ass. And once you start becoming sort of so indestructible, so able to survive anything, so able to pop out of a suit when it's the suit's been ripped apart on your body and land on a convenient platform, it's just hard to kind of get emotionally connected. It was just sort of too easy by the end and there was too much going on. It was sort of jumped the shark in terms of just you need to have some limits. If you don't have some limits, you lose the thing, Matt, that you said you liked, which was that he isn't an actual superhero. Okay.
Right, yeah. I think those are fair criticisms in terms of the, you know, suspension of disbelief. Like, it's asking a lot, you know, for, you know, a seasoned film goer, like in a, you know, I mean, you know, for kids, I don't think it's asking too much, which is probably the target audience, although that shouldn't let him off the hook, right? So I think that, you know, you raised some good points, but I would say that I actually liked the fact that there was a huge part of the narrative of this film, notwithstanding the points you make, but there was a huge part of the narrative that I really enjoyed where he was struggling and dealing with, like, a sort of, you know, in a humorous way, albeit it wasn't treated very seriously, but with a level of, you know, sort of post-traumatic stress or anxiety, and having these sort of panic attacks that they used to sort of comic effect in a way, as a result of the events that took place within the Avengers film, which I thought was kind of interesting to sort of weave that into the story. And I actually enjoyed, although I think, you know, again, you make good points in terms of poking holes in the sort of believability from a, you know, plot perspective. But I did enjoy the fact that a huge part of this movie takes place with him outside of the suit, where it's really not so much about him being there's a character arc, I think, that's really interesting that happens from a plot perspective, or a character perspective anyway, where he goes from being, you know, this kind of perceived invincible form to sort of having this psychological problem and being sort of weak and then being sort of without the suit and the whole. And there was kind of this sort of almost like a 1980s kind of buddy cop movie kind of vibe that was going through the film with the Don Cheadle character and Robert Downey Jr. And then in the end, where it's sort of like there's this sort of falling action where it's as if he's sort of, you know, kind of made whole again or whatever as a person, which I thought was sort of, I don't know. I mean, it's simple and they're simple gags. Like, it's not, you know, Lawrence of Arabia or something in terms of its sophistication as a narrative. But I think in the end, you know, for a comic book film, for me, it had, it was taut and it came together in a way towards the end that I thought worked.
Okay. So my last point that I wouldn't going to throw at you, Ian, which is, because, I mean, there are people that are picking holes in it, and there are funny things like news vans full of Oracle servers, which I'm not quite sure why news vans have to have lots of Oracle servers, but that doesn't take me out of the story. You know, it's kind of funny. And there are some weird, you know, I know people get really wound up on whether or not he's got the arc reactor in his chest and what it's doing and why couldn't he have taken the shot. But I'm not there. I'm just like major plot points that just I go, huh. The one I'm going to ask you about, Ian, is he wakes up in wherever he is in the middle. Where was he? Lands?
It's in Tennessee, isn't it? Or
somewhere like that. Yeah. Okay. So he gets inside the garage of the kid and everything's looking really bad. So, Ian, tell me why he doesn't walk over, pick up a phone on the desk, dial a number and say, "Hi, is Nick Fury there, please?"
You're referring to the fact that this film really seems in isolation from all the events that have just happened with Avengers. I've definitely read a lot about that on the net, and I agree. It was a bit funny to not sort of reference literally Hulk, you know, Captain America and all the other characters. And yeah, I mean, where is Nick Fury in this? It definitely stands alone, and maybe that's all very intentional, but you're kind of left with, oh, well, they're just waiting to put that back in Avengers 2.
I mean, I understand that there are, as a point at the beginning, and it says there's some, you know, people blowing up things, and this is seen as an American problem, not as an Avengers SHIELD problem, though who the hell doesn't think SHIELD is run by the American government? But anyway, but a later stage, after his house is destroyed and the president's in danger and there seems to be like something really serious going down, I mean, isn't it some point that he's going to pick up the phone and say, hey, guys, you know, I don't need all of you, but just, you know, if one of you wouldn't mind just coming over and giving me a lift over to where I need to go in a hurry, that would be really appreciated. I mean, just maybe send a driver from SHIELD rather than me having to steal a car. I was like, what? Why? Heck? I mean, and it's fun having, you know, Banner at the end falling asleep, sitting in the, listening to me tell the story, but it was a bit like, there just was no plausible reason for me why at no point did he not, you know, call in at least a favor from what, after all, are meant to be now pretty good friends and members of the whole SHIELD outfit. Heck, he could have called in, you know, Agent Coulson, who we've now discovered, thanks to trailers, is no longer dead. But
wait, what?
Well, did you not see that TV on the net series this morning? Yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
They're doing a TV series. Yeah.
First thing happened.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you know Agent Coulson? That's the guy that died, right? And then he walks out of the... yeah, don't touch Lola. So that looks great. Don't get me wrong. Okay, so that's enough of picking holes and things and complaining. It is a good film. It is a lot of fun. I think you're on acid and drugs and have some kind of alcohol problem.
I think that
Dark Knight would be inferior to this, but okay. So let's swing to the visual effects. It's the first kind of Iron Man that doesn't have any ILM involvement. In Avengers, ILM did sort of half, I guess, or some major proportion, but not all of Iron Man. So this time we've got a bunch of companies, Ian, that are coming to the party on this. Give us the quick rundown on who's doing suits, because there's a lot of companies. I want to cover every single one, but who's doing the Iron Man suits in this?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably one of the most interesting aspects is that there's at least four companies, if not more, who were sort of doing the same suits even, and that's the Mark 42. But the main companies doing suits were Weta Digital for the Big End Battle, and then Digital Domain, which did that Air Force One crash and skydiving sequence. I think it's called Barrel of Monkeys. And they also contributed a lot to the design of the modeling of the suits. Scanline did a lot of work for that house attack and the suits inside. And then Trickster was did a really cool sequence where Tony Stark's experimenting with the suits flying onto him. Framestore did suits. Luma also did some suit work. So, and you know, I think a couple of the other companies also contributed minor things. So I guess what they've done on this film is really shared the assets around, and I thought that was really successful, actually. You don't really know where one suit ends and the other begins, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, did you learn anything about that at the FMX conference in terms of sharing the assets? Because every one of those companies should, you know, possibly or could possibly have different pipelines. Certainly could be rendering in different renderers. Was that discussed?
Yeah, it was a little bit. And also when we were researching for the article, what sort of happened was originally one company was doing all the suits, and then sort of time caught up, and at least three companies then were doing their own version. But they would share, as I understand it, OBJ files between them. And then Chris Townsend, the overall supervisor, would also share sort of renders out that he said, right, this works. So always follow this method for doing, you know, this sort of look on the metallic surface of the suit, or always do the yellow gold look in this way. And then he'd also share renders where he thought it didn't work. So, you know, which is really the same thing.
Matt, does that surprise you that they're sharing at OBJ level? I mean, that's like kind of ancient Greek of, you know, file formats.
Yeah, I mean, excuse me, sorry. It does surprise me. I think, you know, if you just think about the number of facilities, looking through Ian's article, which, by the way, Ian, great article. I totally dug it. It's a great read. I tweeted about it. I thought anybody, and I sent it to my student Seagraph group to FVCU. I thought people would really get a a lot of information out of it. But I think, you know, if you're going down to kind of that real root level and sharing an asset, in that fashion, then, you know, every facility is almost from, even if there's other shared assets, in order to reassemble all the pieces of that puzzle and put it back together, I mean, you're talking about a pretty significant number of man hours just to get everything kind of in the same zone.
But it's like you said, Mike, I think that the facilities do have different pipelines, and you can't necessarily share rigs, you know, and each facility might render with Arnold or V-Ray or RenderMan. And there was actually at that FMX conference a discussion about better sharing between facilities and how hard that really is, basically all the way from previs to final. And I guess in the past, some facilities have been a bit protective of their own pipeline, but there's kind of more sharing going on with more open source tools out there, you know, Alembic and whatnot. But I don't know, it seemed to work in this show, but it would have been... It does seem also, in the same way, a bit inefficient to have three companies working on the same suit.
Well, I think it presents an interesting problem, too, from the standpoint of visual effects. And it's something that I've just experienced as a, you know, as a practitioner working at different companies. I'm always sort of fascinated going from, you know, one facility to another, how, you know, obviously each facility sort of has its own organic evolution that goes on over the years. And it's interesting. Sometimes you'll go to a facility and they have such a specific pipeline and a set of proprietary tools that do really specific things that you will need to spend, you know, a week or two really in training, essentially, even as a seasoned professional, to be able to kind of get up to speed and understand how things work and how to sort of integrate, you know, your skills and your knowledge into their system. But then there are other facilities, in my experience, who use a lot of, like you say, open source or off-the-shelf solutions with some maybe slightly lighter weight connective tissue designed to help implement those processes in between. And you can wind up at a facility like that, and you can really, you know, arrive on day one, and they can hand you half a dozen shots and say, you know, we want to see progress on all of these by tomorrow morning, right? And so it's sort of a different philosophical approach. And I wonder, and I would love to hear what you guys think about whether or not one approach or another yields better results. In my experience, I don't really know that I would say that I think having the total proprietary pipeline, unless you're doing something super specialized, like maybe the kind of stuff that maybe Lola does, I don't know if it really is an advantage.
I think there are advantages to some custom pipelines. And so my sort of go-to example, that would be, I think Scanline sequence in this film is spectacularly good, and they have specialist skills in water and fluid sim stuff, and it showed. So I think that there are parts of your pipeline, especially destruction parts of your pipeline, that are often, you know, but you don't want to have, like, I don't think, a completely standalone nuke substitute. So, you know, if you don't have nuke and had your own compositor that you wrote from scratch, that would be a hard ask for sharing and getting people to come in and do stuff. So, but, you know, the thing that worried me about the sharing of the suits was the rendering, right? Like, the OBJ is a model sharer, but so much of these suits isn't so much that I'm concerned about the model. It's just like, how do you get the shaders down? Because don't forget, ILM's work on shaders for Iron Man 1 was really landmark in terms of how they went around doing the lighting and the metallic properties of the suit. So have we come so far, and since Iron Man 1 to 3, that, you know, car painty suit stuff is so easy that you can do it at any renderer and they'll all look the same? I don't think so. I imagine that it would have been really still quite hard to get consistency. I think Chris Townsend deserves actually really a big shout out for managing, I think in total, is this right, Ian, 17 studios?
If you count 17 Isla. Studios, that's right. Yeah, so and plus others that are involved in scanning and everything like that as well.
So to get consistency out of that many companies on 2,000 shots, like, Chris Townsend's some kind of effects genius, because that is I don't even know how, but I mean, think about the process of review and matching, and you know, being able to and you have an inherited thing as well, because I mean, I discussed ILM, but Dean Egg did a really good suit, the Mark V, I think, in the Monaco chase. So you've got a history coming in. You've got consistency from that many vendors on this many shots on a film with this much attention.
It's interesting, isn't it? And the other thing is, really, I didn't walk away thinking, oh, Trickster's suit is better than Scanline's suit.
Exactly,
I thought they were all as good as each other. In some ways, they are standalone sequences. And in this film in particular, it gets so much damage over the course of the film that you could almost say the damage film, you know, when he's basically at the end of the house attack and is in Tennessee, is so much different than the original suit when, say, he's giving Pepper a massage.
Okay, but, you know. But no, I didn't have the benefit of the FMX discussion that you had, but we had a really similar in-depth discussion on Avengers at SIDGRAPH last year. And so from that, let me just draw on that and say, like, how a character flies, his stance, his posing, his animation aspects. So let's leave rendering aside now. Let's leave the OBJ model aside and just go straight to the actual core of the animation, because this is a character, the character of the film. Like, let's face it, there's a large section that has Robert Downey Jr., you know, bumming around trying to get a lift, but there are lots of sections where it's, you know, the actor is the animated suit and Robert Downey Jr. is nowhere to be seen. So, you know, like in the discussion that we heard at SIDGRAPH, they were discussing, okay, well, when he's standing, we go for like complete lack of symmetry and these kind of poses, and he, you know, the shoulders are like this to the hips to the how he heroically does it, and this is the thing. Now, when he's flying, we want symmetry, the way that he moves. We want how he flies, but wait a second, we want to use his hands more, so we're going to change the sort of thrust and mechanism for how that moves. And, you know, like there's, you know, how much does he fall? Does he fall like a rag doll? Does he fall like stiff? How much does the suit have kind of a clunkiness to it when it hits at an unexpected kind of object, like he's thrown around kind of thing? Like there's a ton of subtlety to that animation. And all of that, in addition to the model and the rendering, has to be consistent. Or we're just going to go, huh? That doesn't look right. That doesn't look like Iron Man. I mean, we've effectively got, what, how many suits here that all have to have a similarity of animation, a similarity of personality, even if they all look sort of maybe because they're different suits, slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, they got away with a lot too, though, in the sense that... I don't know that I saw too many of the other suits besides the, what do they call them, the Iron Patriot or whatever, and the new Iron Man suit. I don't know that I saw very, you know, up close sort of hero renders of some of the other, like the larger suits. Like they were, at the conclusion of the film, there were so many bits and pieces. I know they had different names for some of them. There was like, you know, what was one of them was like Lover Boy or something like that, I think. And I don't know, all these different names for all of them. And but some of them were more reminiscent of, say, the suit that Jeff Bridges wears in the first Iron Man film, where some of them looked like they had like different kind of proportions and scale with regards to sort of the placement of the shoulders and the width of the chest or and the posture of the neck and the head. And so, you know, the way in which you read them on screen was very different, right? And they had some of them were, you know, silver. Some of them looked almost like they were, you know, a sort of not even really like they were metallic, but not like, you know, really shiny. They were kind of dull. And so there was a wide variance, and the lighting conditions, I think, were such that it was so much, you know, a darker scene happening at night. And I think there was opportunities there for maybe some things, not to say that I think there were problems with any of the renders, but I think maybe it was a bit more forgiving as well.
Okay. But I mean, even if we, so we'll come to the end battle sequence in a second. That had the advantage of mainly being done by Weta, which is 36 suits. But leave that part of it out for a second. If we just go back to the main suit, the new experimental one, that's been created by all these different companies, and it still has to look consistent throughout the film from an animation point of view.
Yeah, the thing is, though, if you start looking at the different sequences, and Iron Man does have sort of certain heroic poses and a way that he does fly, but in some of the different sequences, even the way Iron Man had to act is quite different. So in the scene where he's pretending to be in the suit. You know, when Pepper comes home, that's a much more subtle and almost domestic and casual sort of style of animation. And in the house when it is attacked, he's sort of, he's not necessarily in flying mode. So I guess, like Matt says, they got away with a bit by having different approaches to each scene.
Okay. Well, I mentioned the house attack. I think it's one of the strongest sequences in the film. I thought it was spectacularly good. I loved the product placement of the Audi going in the water. It was hysterical. I thought it was good from a plot point of view. Like, he's all, you know, this is my address, come and get me. And then guess what? He does. And guess what? He just gets blown up. And it was great because it wasn't one of those, you know, super mastermind, I'm going to tell you my plan and give you an adequate amount of time to escape. They just turn up and try and blast him off the face of the planet. I mean, I really just genuinely thought it worked at almost every single level. Matt, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought it was great. And the work that Scanline delivered, you know, in what I guess from Ian's article, right, it's almost entirely photoreal CG. I thought all the particle sim work and the destruction and the, you know, shattering and stuff, I mean, it was just spectacular. Like, it really had sort of a, I mean, the house in and of itself, right, the design that we've seen in the previous two films in the Avengers film, the house itself is sort of absurd, right? It's this kind of, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, spaceship nightmare parked on the edge of this cliff in Malibu. And it's a, seeing it destroyed was both satisfying in some ways in terms of it sort of seeing this architectural nightmare being destroyed, but also the sim work. I mean, it's just that I'm a sucker for anytime I get to see good, you know, FX animation. I love that stuff. And seeing it go from, you know, this sort of whole structure and starting to crumble and break apart, and seeing both the concrete, the glass, you know, the reflected light coming off of the broken glass, the all the dust and the small bits of debris, and then seeing that cascading down the hillside and also churning up some of that kind of, you know, that sort of chaparral kind of, you know, desert hillside that you'd have on the coast of California, and seeing all that stuff plunging towards the water, I thought was just fantastic work. And it really conveyed sort of a powerful moment in the narrative as well. It served the narrative in a great way in that it was really the sort of, you know, the destruction of and the facing of this challenge, you know, of our hero in the story, right? So I thought it worked on so many levels. I really thought it was great work.
And it was Brian Grill at Scanline that helmed that, was it?
Brian Grill was the co-VFX suit with Darren Poe. And the most interesting thing I think about that sequence is that basically Scanline started on it before any principal photography had taken place. You know, just another way to sort of highlight the role of visual effects. And obviously visual effects were going to help make this sequence. But because they could no longer, like they had in the previous films, shoot, you know, helicopter plates of the Malibu location, well, they weren't allowed to get as close as they used to be able to get. They basically said, well, let's just do this as completely CG, as long as we can make it photoreal. And, you know, I think it is. You know, those exterior shots with the helicopters are just brilliant.
Yeah, really, it was reminiscent, I think, the crumbling and decay of what I still think was one of the most, not one of my favorite movies by any stretch, but one of the most interesting visual effects sequences, which was in the, I believe it was the third Transformers film, and the destruction of that one large tower that falls over, and how you saw all the, I remember that shot so vividly, and thinking that I felt like I was seeing something where there was some new ground being broken at that time in terms of the number of particles in that sequence. And this was reminiscent of that, not quite on that same scale, but it had that same kind of incredible photorealistic thing that you'd expect to see, having, you know, sort of all had the, I guess, unfortunate opportunity of having seen, you know, real large structures, man-made structures, actually, you know, crumble. It was interesting how they were able to achieve something with a completely computer-generated environment. I thought it really worked great.
Now, Ian, Scanline obviously has their own, as I alluded to, huge investment in fluid sims with Flowline. But also they used Thinking Particles on this, I believe. And Thinking Particles is interesting because it's basically a 3D Max product. I mean, normally we'd sort of see a Maya pipeline or a Destruction pipeline, but I mean, Thinking Particles has been around for like 10 years or so. But am I right in thinking that that's what they were using for the...
Yeah, they were using, I think they these days, they really use a combination of everything. But for the sort of rigid body damage, it was thinking particles. And then Flowline was really handling sort of the main simulations of smoke and water. And of course, you know, the sequence continues into the water as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, thinking particles has produced a lot of, you know, that kind of practical effects type animation work. And I think we saw it last in, was it Avengers or Battleship? It's one of those two that I remember we it came up with. It's a very solid kind of procedural approach. I think procedural effects stuff just adds such production value. But I also think, Matt, you touched on it, the lighting on this just was really nice. I mean, you can do that kind of great lighting. And it was an attractively lit, you know, Hollywood-type scene. I mean, it was just, you know.
Yeah, it's all takes place at, you know, magic hour, right? The sun is setting out over the Pacific, and so you're getting this really great, you know, raking light coming across everything, including all the, you know, destruction of the bits of the concrete and the glass and whatnot. And, I mean, it really makes for a really spectacular-looking scene.
Now, Pepper's saved with the Mark 42 in this, and Pepper will end up getting quite a lot of, I mean, gosh, I should have said spoilers at the outset, right? But anyway, I assume everyone's seen it if they're listening to it.
That's a given.
But yeah, so Pepper's going to get her own super sort of hero-esque, superhero powers in this film. So can you perhaps comment, Matt, on firstly Pepper's arc, whether you, because a lot of people I know are kind of upset that she was in the suit, but also we'll go into the extremist look, which I think
no
is really interesting.
No girls allowed in the Iron Man suit. It's Iron Man. No, I mean, I actually thought that was the one thing, well, maybe there's a couple things, but that was one of the things that I personally was not crazy about. I didn't have a problem with her being in the suit and being, you know, saved that way by being in the suit. I mean, you know, it was definitely funny seeing a different, like a female head, you know, in the suit and sort of thinking about how, I guess Robert Downey Jr. is sort of just of average height and she's probably a little bit tall. So maybe it works, but, you know, that notwithstanding, I think the thing that I sort of had a problem with was the nature of the suit itself. I found this was the, you're going to think this is absurd. I don't know why this is the thing I would pick out as being the thing that sort of, you know, was the suspension of disbelief part that I didn't buy. But the fact that the suit can fly, each individual piece of the suit is fitted with like these little retro rockets and jets that allow it to sort of somehow fly. So not only is it a suit that can be worn as armor and functions as part of a larger sort of thing that can be worn, but it also, each individual piece is aerodynamic, has enough fuel and a navigation system sophisticated enough to allow it to transport and fly around and then assemble on a person. I mean, so I don't know. I had some issues with that whole, I mean, it looks cool, you know, it's, and it made for a really neat kind of effect, you know, when you, it's similar to the, I guess, the suitcase suit, which I think was in the second movie.
Yeah.
But, so it's, you know, it's, right, yeah, so it's similar in ways, right, in terms of the way it kind of, it almost looks like it's sort of, you know, like a, what am I thinking of, like a, I don't know, like a slinky or something, or like a, it's, you know, like a puzzle that's assembling itself on your body, right? But I found that the whole essence of the conceit of that suit, the Mark 42, that it can break apart and each individual piece can fly. Now, it wound up becoming, you know, it was important to the way in which they constructed the script for the story and the way that everything would happen. But I found that a little bit weird overall.
The one cool thing about that, though, that I liked what they did was they didn't necessarily have a glove piece that looked like a glove when it was on the table. It it looked like something else. In fact, it almost
looked
had
a bit like a glove when it was giving him a hand underwater.
Well, I guess some of the other pieces, if it wasn't the glove but boot or whatnot, sort of more were aerodynamic, as you say, Matt, and that meant that when they actually went on to Iron Man or Tony Stark, that they became that slinky-like look. And I kind of like that because I would have thought gloves flying in the air would have looked a bit silly.
It was a fun sequence when he first had it assembling, especially the groin shot. But, yeah, I hadn't stopped to think about how absurd it is to have each piece able to fly of its own thing, though it was. It did lead to a good effect sequence. So I was going to go to extremists, but we'll come back to that. it did lead to a very good effect sequence when he's partly suited up and he's fighting the guys in the evil lair after the woman that wouldn't set him free with a couple of table ties then was willing to kill herself over him 3 minutes later. He's got a glove on and I think one boot, is that right, when he starts that fight sequence? Yeah. Now, see, I think that was a good piece of film because we as an audience know that if he had the full suit, he's wiping these guys out in no time flat. So having him only partly suited, therefore off balance, makes for a great little kind of action sequence and a completely plausible fight ending in what I think one of the funniest jokes in the film with that guy coming in at the end. Ian, what do you think?
I love that bit when he goes, they're really weird or something like that, doesn't
he? Really weird.
It's a cool sequence, and I could be wrong, but it seems like a bit of a throwback to sort of the first film as well, in the way that he would be fighting in that sort of very practical way. And it's great, and he even manages to sort of do that flip in the air, and I like that.
How'd they pull that off, Ian?
That's an interesting shot, because I think it was pre-vised to be this sort of a flip and whatnot, and they had a very complicated rig on set, but they basically didn't have enough space to film the flip, so they redid the shot in a green screen sort of box, with a flip rig and whatnot. And so Trickster, using a scan of the original room and partly digi double parts of Robert Downey Jr., sort of pieced that together.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good sequence. There's a few sequences in this that benefited from the practicality of having somebody. Like that one benefited from having Robert Downey Jr. very physically present in the frame, not being just. I mean, there were some digital doubles, I know, but there was also a lot of just him doing stuff. I mean, the biggest one was the Barrel of Monkeys, right? Actually having these people jumping out of real planes and filming them. Okay, yes, you had to remove the lumps from their concealed parachutes on their back. But there was an enormous amount of reality added. Again, Ian, do you just want to give us a quick rundown on how DD handled that? And in particular, how Eric actually had a bit of a skydiving experience himself.
Yeah. I mean, the DD soup is Eric Nash, and he told us that he'd done about 1,300 jumps himself. So he knew, you know, what it was like to come out of a plane, and he knew what it looked like and how it should feel. So they basically shot the sequence for real with this Red Bull skydiving team. And one of the guys was dressed in like a soft Iron Man colored suit. And then the rest of the jumpers were, you know, in sort of that Air Force One attire. So they filmed it for real. Some guy was also jumping with them with a red camera on his helmet. And then what they had to do was replace the Iron Man jumper with obviously a digital Iron Man, and then also replace a lot of the background, because I think they're jumping over Miami, isn't it? So, and then, you know, put in Air Force One breaking up in the background. So you're right, Mike, that they could have done the sequence probably totally digital, but then you just wouldn't have got that feeling about how it looks to be weightless like that and to jump like that. So it definitely worked for me.
I've got a podcast interview with Eric discussing that shot, and one of the things that actually leaked before the film came out was a production happy snap from somebody that was in Miami of the crane hanging the actors on wires, which we discussed in that podcast. So imagine you've got all these people that are being saved by all holding onto each other, and the slightly implausible thing of having electric volts put through them so that their hands freeze up without upsetting anyone's heart. But, yeah, okay, whatever. So they're all hanging onto each other, and this is the reference to the Barrel of Monkeys. To do it for real, they've got all these people suspended on a bunch of wires off this massive crane for the sequence when they approach Earth and the water. So obviously up in the air you can actually have people skydiving, but once you get closer to Earth, you clearly either have to have your chute open or you've got serious problems. So that last part, you've got people hanging upside down in this rig, which is a real ask actually for stunt people to do, because, you know, blood rushing to your head and just the whole problem of being wet and cold and upside down on a wire. And film crews, I'm sure, move as quickly as they possibly can, but no film crew can move as fast as I bet you'd like them to move if you were hanging upside down wet on a piece of wire off the Florida coast. Matt, did you find the sequence satisfying, visually effects-wise? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think from a visual effects point of view, I think it works really well. I thought the fact that they shot a lot of the aerial stuff, you know, practically, and then did a lot of retouching and adding stuff back in, I think really works well. It does lend an air of believability to the sequence. It reminded me a bit of that famous sequence from, I think it's from, I want to say that Roger Moore 007 film Moonraker at the beginning, where they right where they do the skydiving and they try to make themselves aerodynamic so they can fly or whatever. I remember seeing that as a kid, and but in that sequence you can see the chutes that they're wearing under their suits, and the digital work in this was really great, the removal of all that, and then the aesthetic and the look of the characters, the insertion of Iron Man into the sequence, I think works really well. And I love you didn't see much of it, but it was in the background, the destruction of Air Force One in the background, I thought was really cool. And, added a lot of sort of harrowing elements to the sequence, where you're sort of like, you know, how many are there? You know, how many can I carry? And then, you know, kind of creating a really fun, summer blockbuster style sequence out of it. I thought it worked really great.
DD used their real steel pipeline out, which was Mayer and V-Ray. But the shout out I want to give is respect to the wire removal guys, because Eric mentioned it, and I know separately from just around the traps that this was one mother of a wire removal, rig removal sequence, because people had rigs from other people crossing them and their rigs, you know, making up their clothes, and then there's the parachutes, and just apparently it was just a monster effort from the team at DD. So congrats to those guys. I don't take nothing away from the guys doing the suits, but, you know, yeah, it's always easy for us to focus on the hero. But those guys doing that rig removal must have had a hell of a job cut out for them. Okay, so that gets me back to Extremis, which is one of the other huge kind of visual effects aspects of the film. This idea that you're going to have some kind of inner healing property that if it goes awry will cause you to blow up, and if you're a plant it'll leave an impression on a wall, and if you're not a plant it'll just leave everybody else's impressions on walls. I think, Matt, you actually even tweeted or posted something that you thought that the subsurface kind of effect on that was just a cracker.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all the effects in the film, I mean, I love all the big sort of giant effects that, you know, and all the Iron Man suits and stuff. I think all that stuff is always so much fun, but I really like the Extremis effect in particular, just because the subsurface look and the way in which the glow that came, you know, whether it was in the head or in the arm or, even when they did it to the metal or to the suit, the depth of the glow, how deep it looked like it was inside of the character, and how there was all the sort of particle work that was sort of the blacker areas or the darker areas within the skin that was kind of moving. I just thought it was so neat, and it was such a, it was creepy looking. Like, it was creepy and kind of freaky, and you sort of were wondering, like, well, what is this? You know, is it some sort of, you know, like nanobots or nanites or something under the skin, or is it some sort of a weird, you know, biological thing? You were never totally clear on exactly what it was, but I thought the way that it looked and the way that they brought it out through the character's eyes as well, I thought was really cool. And it kind of just, it had this sort of, like a molten kind of lava kind of look to it that was so interesting. And so I just thought it was cool. It felt, pretty fresh as an aesthetic. It felt like something I hadn't seen in another film quite in that way, integrated into human form.
And who was providing that effect?
Well, again, it's one of those ones that was shared amongst facilities, and that's, you know,
wow.
like with the suits, I think you never really knew who was behind it. Some of the main companies obviously were Weta for the final sequence, but also Framestore did a lot of shots and did a lot of look dev that sort of got shared around. Method Studios also did the Extremis effect when that water tower crashes. And like you say, Matt, one thing I really liked about the effect was that it always looked like it was coming from within the body. It wasn't something done on the surface. And I think, you know, whichever technique they use, one thing was always you kind of got a glimpse of veins or bones within the surface. And I think that really helped sort of sell that it was, oh, it's not just skin-based, it's within.
Was there something at the end about that effect that caused Weta to have to do a Guy Pearce thing? What was that?
Yeah, well, they were already doing some extremist work, obviously, for Pepper and bits of Killian, Guy Pearce, you know, going a bit crazy. But they apparently... they apparently amped up the sequence, after shooting had wrapped. And basically, by that time, Guy Pearce had gone on to his next film, and he had to grow a beard for his next film. So, you know, he doesn't have a beard in Iron Man 3, obviously. So, you know, instead of shooting Guy Pearce and sort of finding some way to get rid of his beard, they filmed the sequence, the sort of new part of the sequence, for Guy Pearce reference. Then they did one of their fax reference shoots, which is, geez, I could get this wrong, but facial action coding system.
Yeah.
You know, which Weta really has mastered in the last couple of films, and basically did a complete digi double of him. And that was basically the sequence where he's just really extremising out and bits of skin are flaking off and it really looks like almost lava and molten pieces there. But yeah, basically that was their solution to not having to deal with him having a beard.
And that's incredible, isn't it? You just the thought you'd get an actor back and they'd be like, okay, well, I just now have, you know, a beard. And it, well, okay, we'll shave that off. Well, sorry, I can't do that. yeah. Okay, that'd be interesting to know what that... Was that the Rover that he went on to? Because that was a film here, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was because I... Yeah, not sure.
Right, because I know that he did an Australian film after that that was written by Joel Edgerton, I think. But maybe that's not the one that he went on to. But yeah, that's really interesting. So, okay, so can we tell when he's digital him or not him? I mean, I guess it's a hell of a match moving job, even if you have the actor to get the extremist effect onto the actor to look like it's under the skin of the actor, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I could tell a digital version of him other than obviously, you know, knew that he'd been majorly affected by the...
Yeah, I had no idea about that until I read that in the article. I thought that was so... I would not have guessed. It was not in any way obvious.
I think at some point Weta had done a digital body of him, you know, where you're obviously seeing his upper torso and on the tattoos. But they'd always, you know, use the real parts of Guy Pearce's performance and put the extremist effect underneath. But there is one sequence where you're right up to his face that we saw at FMX where it's basically a digital Killian. And we're watching this presentation before the films come out and no one could tell that he was completely digital until Guy Williams, who's the VFX super at Weta, showed the breakdown. And it really sort of blew the room away.
Hmm. Well, I've got to say, apart from the fact that I found it immensely funny that Happy was watching Downton Abbey. just classic. It was nice to actually see the original director, who obviously plays that character, Jon Favreau, in the... Obviously not, how can I put this? He was still a friend of the production and happy to help out and be in it. And his mullet was also another standout moment for me. This is not really visual effects related, but I think it's kind of worth touching on. This film had a completely different edit for China. But normally, you know, you'd say, oh, they cut out this bit or they cut out that bit. There's like some sex scene that some Chinese censor doesn't like. But here, we didn't just have an edited down version of Iron Man. We actually had a Chinese edit with additional scenes featuring the Dr. Wu and his assistant character, which I think is kind of pretty interesting, actually. I'm not ever aware of that happening. Does anyone else know?
The only other one that I remember that happening a little bit in was Looper, because, you know, obviously not a big film like this, but still a sci-fi one. And because it was partially funded by Chinese money, they did some additional work when actually the film goes to Shanghai and other places. But no, I didn't know. I don't know any other film where there are so many differences and also totally new characters.
Because the film was quite long already, wasn't it? So, I mean, in terms of making stuff up, they have to have an extra... I mean, a wonderful...
It's interesting. I, Yeah, I wonder why or what is the... I mean, are the cultural differences between, you know, a Chinese movie-going audience and an American movie, or, a Western world movie-going audience, are they so great that that becomes something that is deemed really significant and really important? I know there's, China has its own, burgeoning and pretty significant film community of their own, where they, tell stories that are sort of more specifically, Chinese-driven stories, as opposed to one like this, which is like a, pretty over-the-top superhero film. But I think it's interesting. It's a really interesting choice to make. I know that part of the financing for the film also came from, deals and pre-sales, foreign sales for the Chinese market. So maybe this was part of that brokering of that deal and the studio's attempts to continue to really make more money and to garner revenue streams from, sort of the emergence of this, really the world's largest market in China. So yeah, it's an interesting choice for sure.
I can only go off what IMDb has said, but apparently the actors were in 10 seconds of the domestic/international version of the film, but they're in an additional 3 minutes where Tony Stark seeks out the doctor for acupuncture to help him with his injuries. I don't exactly know where that sits in the plot, but that's what that's like 3 minutes of additional footage that isn't a cultural kind of, we're going to explain something you wouldn't get. This is like a, a scene for Chinese audiences to enjoy. I know that in a number of occasions on sort of big blockbuster films, I think going back to Independence Day, they would have different shots of different cities being either blown up or heroes from those cities appearing to fight on an international level. And so if you're in Australia, you got a shot of like the Sydney Opera House, and if you're in France, you got a shot of the Eiffel Tower kind of thing. But that that always felt to me like it was like a, I don't know, 3-4 second shot drop in that you would just do to make local media kind of happy. This feels like more than that.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing to do. Like I wonder if, for the audiences who see the film in China and they go to see it, and if they are aware of, if anybody reads a story about it and maybe is aware of these additional scenes, I wonder if it feels like it's integrated well into the story, or are things like that. Like I would have a tendency to think, like, maybe just because, I'm a cynical California kid at heart or something, but maybe I would have a tendency to feel like I was being pandered to or something. It's like, oh, come on, you don't have to, what is this supposed to do for me, adding this kind of thing? I don't know. And so I'd be curious, if anybody listening, who lives in China maybe, or who saw this film over there, if they had any feelings about what they saw, and if they know what was different.
So Jim Shen, who works here in our office, in fact, is like incredibly valued key member of my team, was born in Shanghai and is going back there in about 10 days. So if he hasn't beforehand, I'll get him to kind of see what he can find out about it for us, and we'll pick it up in a future show. Hey, so this was something about this film that we haven't even mentioned, and interestingly, I don't feel compelled to mention, other than to point to the fact we're not discussing it, is the fact that this was shown in 3D. Is the 3D sort of aspect of a film like this now just so unimportant that people like the three of us don't even sort of bring it up until the closing minutes of the show? I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, that would have been a big point. Had this film been Iron Man 1 in 3D, we'd have spent a lot of time talking about the stereo.
I agree. I didn't even see this film in 3D.
Neither did I.
Yeah, but I've heard and I've read reviews that the 3D is sort of pretty subtle, and it's sort of not touted like some of the other 3D films of the last couple of years have been.
I think too, with the sort of the non-natively shot 3D, I think that was a big deal, I think, 2 years ago. But I think now we're seeing work that's being done sort of post-dimensionalized. And I think the post-dimensionalizations that I've been seeing, with some of the other films that we've talked about recently on the show, I mean, I feel like it's really indistinguishable. I mean, some of it's so well done that it's, it almost seems like it can be, for some of these studios, like almost an afterthought. Not that it's an afterthought for the people doing the dimensionalization, but I think, you know, there's certainly a market for it. Apparently, it's a huge market in some of these for 3D in some of the more emerging areas, like we were talking about earlier, like China. I think it's really popular, but I think I don't see, you know, in my local area here, people aren't as overly excited about 3D. Like, they don't have to see a movie in 3D. Like, I've had people say, oh, you know, well, whatever, whichever one's playing. Like, is it the 3D one? Oh, no? Oh, cool. Well, it'll be cheaper. You know, like, it's not necessarily a selling point, I think, for people, at least, you know, anecdotally, anyway, in my community.
What's interesting, and I think I made this on a point to Jeff Huser on a different podcast, which was that now the U.S. box office is a smaller proportion of the global money. Now, it's not necessarily that the U.S. box office has shrunk. It's just that the rest of the world has grown up around it. So instead of it being used to be a 50-50 split, you know, whatever you did locally, you did domestically and vice versa. Now it's more like a third U.S. box office, two-thirds outside the U.S. And I think these two issues are really a reflection of that. I think both the 3D stereo, as you say, playing strongly in overseas markets, and the idea of doing entire scenes for an overseas, maybe Asian audience, both reflect that fact that, you know, two-thirds of the money for this film's profits are coming from outside the U.S.
Well, it's definitely so interesting, yeah, that that's become like a big part of definitely the sort of Hollywood studio tentpole filmmaking machine. You know, what I think could be really exciting, and what I hope we start to see a lot more of, is, you know, some of these, you know, larger than sort of the North American market, some of these other emerging markets where people are really getting hungry for more and more, you know, entertainment products and cinema, that you'll start to see with some of these new kind of less expensive tools for filmmakers, you'll see some more, you know, independent, local flavor films coming out of those markets and being distributed in really fun and interesting ways, where, you know, we'd get a chance to see some of, you know, that point of view over here. You know, that would be really cool.
Is it a testament to just how good the, you know, D Cinema kind of 3D version of the film is? Is it a reflection of just how spectacularly well the dimensionalization guys are working that we aren't commenting on it? Because I've got to be thinking that, you know, it used to be, we talked about it because it was a travesty against humanity, and then it was just, you know, we were screaming we didn't want to see this or that. And now we're going, yeah, it was the 3D version, non-3D version, as if that's a trivial exercise. And we're not saying that. I know you explicitly said that isn't. But, I mean, I can't even begin to think how I would dimensionalize that end sequence with the fight on the, you know, it's okay, it's all 3D in many respects, and I don't know what files were handed over, but, you know, the destruction sequence at the beginning, the end sequence, pick a sequence, you know, snow falling, you know, extremist effects going on. I mean, I don't even know how they would do that. And I do know technically how they do it, but I think it'd be sitting there at the front of this project going, good Lord. I guess we've just, these guys have become so good that we're no longer discussing them, which must be both a compliment and annoyance to if the guys are actually doing the work.
Yeah. Well, I think there was probably, yeah, I agree. And I think there probably was, you know, that first year or two where the films that weren't shot natively in 3D, there was kind of that, you know, hue and cry about like, oh, it doesn't, you know, it looks so weird, and like, oh, I got a headache, and it's wrong, they're doing it wrong. And I think, you know, whatever went wrong with the sort of that first batch of, I think it was really only like, you know, three or four films that really kind of garnered the lion's share of criticism for the dimensionalization. But it seems like, you know, a lot of the issues that were sort of, you know, brought to the fore, a lot of that stuff seems like it's sort of fallen by the wayside now, where it's not, I don't hear people saying anything derogatory about the 3D anymore. So I think they really have turned a corner, like all the men and women that do that post-dimensionalization. It seems like there's really, you know, a mastery of that craft, and they're delivering the goods like at a high yield, where people are really satisfied with what they're seeing. So I think it's, you know, credit goes to all the people that work in those facilities that are doing that work. I mean, it's got to be I would imagine, some of the most painstakingly, you know, difficult in terms of separating things out and, you know, the amount of roto that I bet you'd have to do for some of those bits and pieces, I think would just be insane, really difficult.
It's changing too, isn't it? Because I think at first people were sort of against it, A, because it sort of strained your eyes, and B, because it was also more expensive to watch a film in 3D.
Right.
But at least in Australia, that's changing a little bit. I actually did seek out this film in 3D, and I saw it in England, but we just happened to be in a screening that was not 3D, even though we rocked up with our 3D glasses, and which is really
How long
funny.
Did it take you to work that out?
Straight away.
Okay.
but I actually like 3D.
This film was dark. Huh? Sorry. Yeah.
You know, I actually like 3D as a bit of an experience, and the last couple of films I've seen in 3D have totally worked, and sometimes you sort of, by the end of the film, you've forgotten, you know, that you've got the glasses on, and you know, I would have liked to have seen this in 3D, and perhaps still will.
Well, maybe we'll revise that when we come to talk about Star Trek, which I can't talk about just yet, but I've seen it in 3D IMAX. Mm. You couldn't miss the 3D-ness. The thing that I was going to say, Ian, and I thought might also play into this, and I thought that might be the point you were going to make, I have heard some criticism of, say, Gatsby on 3D because they have got heavy use of 3D. Maybe one of the other factors on this is that the dimensionalization guys are doing a terrific job. Take nothing away from them. But also the director isn't pushing for sight gags. So in Journey to the Center of the Earth 1, you know, they picked up a yo-yo for no apparent reason and spun it around just to have it go out in the audience. And that's a directorial decision. That's gone away. And they're not cranking up the amount of stereo, so you not get a lot of stuff like right up in your face. As a consequence, you know, it's a combination of the two things, right? We're not criticizing it because it's badly done technically, but we're also not criticizing it because it's gimmicky in your face or there are stupid shots that the only point of that shot was to have a gag.
Yeah, well, it's almost like, as Matt says, there were literally three films about 3 years ago that were just so bagged out that I think directors and filmmakers are so scared of a review of their film only mentioning the 3D and how much it takes you out of the film that they've kind of scaled back a bit.
Have you seen what I'm talking about with Great Gatsby? Because I've seen a little bit of that.
Yeah, I have. And again, I'm not sure if that film was it dimensionalized or shot in 3D?
No, it was shot in 3D.
Right, yeah.
Okay, well, it is a really good film. It is absolutely not better than the godfather of superhero films, which is, of course, Dark Knight.
But it's way more fun.
But on an unrelated point, it's the last show that Matt will be on the VFX show. And I wanted to say thank you, Matt, for all your time and contribution.
Well,
and,
it's been a pleasure.
No, I'm just joking. I'm completely joking. Never get rid of Matt in a million years. Yeah, but look, you seriously owe me some beers over this.
Drinks are on me at Seagraph. How's that?
Yeah, there you go. I do think that it's a good film. I do think that it has ridiculous plot holes, so that stopped it from me being magnificent and therefore not in the same class as, say, Avengers. And I think I was partly a bit annoyed because some of the hype going in, which I fell for, said things like, you know, wow, after the director of Avengers saw the ending of Iron Man 3, he was like, oh my God, where are we going to do for Avengers 2? And I would say, well, that's just rubbish. You've got a lot of places you can go with Avengers 2. I mentioned Jon Favreau before as Happy Hogan was really good. I do also think we should give a shout out to Ben Kingsley as the Mandarin.
Oh,
who just
oh
delivered a killer performance. I just thought it was so good.
And I don't know about you guys, but I knew nothing about the like pretty awesome and hilarious twist in that story. I knew nothing about that going in, and so I just thought it was awesome. It was so funny. I mean, that was part of it too. I laughed out loud like a number of times during this film because there were so many just like funny gags and bits that they sort of incorporated into this piece, and you know, all the little riffing with the you know, smart alecky little kid and stuff. I don't know, I dug that stuff. It was funny. And yeah, Ben Kingsley was great. And I was gonna say too, you mentioned him earlier, but I can't remember his name now. What's his name?
Can I just sound that Ben Kingsley thing? When he first walked in on the two hookers and Ben Kingsley came out looking kind of all like, I actually thought, because it was Ben Kingsley, I thought the actor was so evil that he was pretending like he wasn't the evil one. And then the second that Iron Man sort of was turned, then he'd come out. He would be the evil one. I mean, it was just... I think Ben...
And I love that he called him Ringo, too. That was great. But I was going to say... I was going to say, too, I thought it was so great to see Guy Pearce in a big blockbuster movie like this. I hadn't seen him, aside from, you know, his... what I still think was his horrible... his great performance, which was horribly distorted by the terrible makeup in Prometheus. I hadn't seen him in a film, where he had a large role, except for, I guess he was in that
Time Machine.
I was actually thinking of the one, Nick Cage movie that he was in, that Western, I can't remember the name of it now.
No, it's, oh gosh.
Not great Nick film. Cage. No, wait. Nick.
Can I just
musician.
Say though, he was very good as the. He was very
but
good.
He was great.
He was very good as the king in the King's Speech, the one that obviously abdicated, and he had a small role at the beginning of Hurt Locker, which I just thought was awesome. It made me want to see more of him. But the film
he's
you
a
have
great
to,
actor, and I think
you have to mention Memento. Memento is
of course absolutely
yeah anyone that's not seen Memento and listens to this show go and see Memento. It is
the film you're thinking about is The Proposition.
That's my favorite. The Proposition, that's right.
Yeah,
and I would say Memento is still my favorite Christopher Nolan movie.
Oh yeah, it is. It is a masterpiece. It is so intelligent that it's humbling to watch. It's almost you watch that film and think
But I'd like to see more Guy Pearce in more movies. I think he's in maybe even some more like leading roles. I think he's a great actor. He's got a lot of, you know, presence on screen. I think it'd be fun to see him in more stuff.
Well, L.A. Confidential, I think, was another good one. But you're right, for the last few years.
I agree, but that's a long time ago, you know.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Sorry, were you going to say something, Ian? We cut you off?
Oh no! Just I just as we're wrapping up, I wanted to also shout out Cantina Creative, who did the HUDs, the HUDs for Iron Man. I mean, they'd also worked on a couple of the previous films, and I just thought they've sort of got so good now that we don't necessarily talk about them that much. But you know, they sort of, I think they've really developed their HUDs to sort of feel more 3D even, whereas they probably used to feel more like screen graphics. And I just felt like they worked really well in this film too.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I saw them do a presentation at NAB and I was really impressed with the level of thought that goes into those graphics, because there's an entire kind of backstory that they weave in to make them logical, which I don't think you decode at one level, and yet at another they feel to sort of make sense. They don't pull you out of the film. They're not just they look like a jumble of graphics if you were maybe not in the film industry, and if you're in the industry you'd be hard push not to admire the work. I totally agree. That's a good point. Well, is there anything, I guess we haven't done it, but is there anything of an effects nature that we didn't like? I've criticized some plot points, but we just didn't actually criticize anything, I don't think. Was there any shots that you didn't like? I'm actually going to say, I'll lead you off to give you guys a chance to think. There were actually some shots, while I complimented the consistency that was across the animation in most respects, there were some incidental shots of the suit moving where it seemed quite robotically dissimilar to some of the other scenes we'd seen. I couldn't work out whether it was a lack of motion blur, so the shorter shutter made it seem like it was more sort of like stop framey, more robotic, or the animators, and these were not hero fight scenes. These weren't, you know, ones we've discussed. It wasn't in the, for example, opening house destruction. It wasn't in Weta's thing at the end. There was more like shots in the middle of the film where there'd just be like two shots of him turning. I remember there was one sort of low camera Dutch shot and I went, oh, I kind of just like pulled back for a second. And then I thought to myself, well, of course, it'd be really hard to get that suit always looking the same. And I didn't see that inconsistency in compositing or in lighting, but I did see a couple of shots where it just felt like the movement, I guess, of the suit. He's standing on the ground by when he's doing this. It's not a flying sequence. Just felt unlike it was viable. You would have seen the shot in isolation and said it was okay. It just didn't sit in with the movements that we were seeing from the suit around it. That would be my only kind of major effects criticism.
Yeah, it's in, It's interesting that you say that, because I didn't see that stuff. I remember seeing one shot of the Iron Man suit, I think, walking down stairs or something. It's walking really clunkily down the stairs, but I thought that was a... I think that's actually a story point at one moment in the scene. But, you know, there's a guy who's a former FX PhDer who I've actually met through you guys out at Seagraph, this guy Judd Pratt, who also lives out in L.A. now, and he and I correspond sometimes, and he was asking me if I had seen that, and he said he thought some of the Iron Man walking animations were really clunky, and so he saw some of that same stuff, but I hadn't noticed it. A couple other things that I guess I would say that I thought were a little bit weird. I thought there were a couple bits where when the suit is, we don't know it's the suit, we think it's him, but when he's giving the massage, there was a couple bits where it seemed like the hands and the shoulders, like they didn't quite track correctly. Like it felt like there was a couple things that were just sliding a little bit. They were a little bit off, and it felt sort of pasting on. But I mean, you know, most of the, if anything that I could sort of pick out, I think it would be so sort of real. I'm be really being nitpicky. Like, I think I looked for, you know, any bad comps. I didn't see any really thing that stuck out. I thought, you know, again, like you said at the beginning of the show, I think, you know, Chris Townsend, who I knew him back in the 90s, the early to mid 1990s at Industrial Light and Magic, when he was just a lowly lighting TD, and you know, and he's such a great guy, such a nice guy, and I really think what you said earlier is true. I mean, with so many facilities contributing, you know, really great work to this project, I mean, he really does deserve, and his team, you know, they deserve a lot of credit for being able to get all this stuff to look so consistent through so many different kinds of effects from so many different places, too. So, I mean, I just didn't see that much that really stuck out. I don't know. What about you, Ian?
I'm trying to think of something that didn't quite work for me, but I'm not sure I can. The only thing that... And it might have been the cinema that I saw it in, and I just love Weta's final destruction sequence, and you know, the crane falling and all the suits and the extremists. But it was quite a dark sequence, and I guess that's part of just being in a big seaport. But oftentimes, because there was so much action going on, I couldn't always follow it. It may well be the intent, but part of that sequence to me was quite dark.
Yeah. But don't you think that sort of a little bit goes back to my point about at the very beginning of the show, which is they kind of almost jumped the shark with just making it too over the top, too suit after suit after jump out of in and out of a suit and land on this and swing around to that. And it's just like, okay, so because they've done such a good job earlier with him being human, and I mean that in the sense of a humanizing performance, that at the end it was just a bit like, it was almost like a Houdini exercise in suit jumping. I don't know. That's why I found it disorientating.
Well, the one thing about that, Mike, is that you made this point right at the beginning of the show, which is as soon as you don't believe a character is in peril anymore, you can sometimes stop, you know, worrying about them. And I think because he's able to control all these suits and jump in and out of them, there's a point where he is, you know, almost too much of a superhero and won't die, which is different than in, say, the second film where, you know, he's literally being affected by the reactor and, you see that effect on his skin. And I don't think you feel like that about Tony Stark in this film, even though I love that sequence.
I do say, though, that the end of the Barrel of Monkeys sequence with the truck, I laughed out loud at that. That was good. That was I was very, him not in the suit paid off then. I just, yeah, at the end it was a bit over the top.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ian, any shots you didn't like?
Not that I can think of, no.
Well, that's it then for this episode. We want to thank you guys so much for being with us and, of course, our hosts for joining us, Matt. Obviously, we talked at the beginning of the show about your teaching, but do you want to just give a link to more information on that?
Yeah, I mean, really anything and everything that I'm doing, I've got going on, is at my website, and it's mattwallin.com.
And Ian, do you want to discuss the VFX blog in addition to, of course, FX Guide?
Yeah, well, obviously you can read things that I've written at FX Guide, but also I'm have vfxblog.com, which is links to various visual effects articles, film-related things, and FX guide things. So I've been running that now for, since about 2003, I think. And it's always interesting who rocks up there and visits it.
Yeah, so VFX Blog, for those of you that don't know, if there's a new trailer that comes out or somebody from an effects company publishes a cool thing and it isn't something that we'd put on FX Guide, for example, MPC has a new website. Well, we're not going to post on FX Guide that MPC has a new website particularly. Not that we, you know, don't wish them all the best. They're great guys, but it's just not the sort of thing that we'd run a story on. All of that kind of stuff goes in this very funky, cool VFX blog that Ian runs. Now, of course, he also links back to stories that are posted on FX Guide and other stuff around the net. But yeah, it's just a great one-stop shop. It's kind of like a visual Twitter was the way I'd probably describe it, Ian. It's
yeah, exactly. No, it's fun to do.
And with respect to Twitter, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter, but of course you'll find me over at FX Guide. Well, look, it's been really, really great. There are a lot of good films coming up. Ian, maybe we can just quickly yell out to some of the stuff that's just coming down the pipe, because it really is, as somebody said, it's shaping up to be one of those killer summers that, you know, you'll look back on in a decade and say, wow, we were spoilt that year.
It is a killer summer, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm looking at Gravity trailer on your VFX blog. That's one of the ones coming up. But there's a ton of stuff in the short term, isn't there?
Yeah, there's obviously Star Trek that comes out really soon. If not, it's already out in Australia. And then there's other films like Fast and Furious 6 and After Earth, Man of Steel, which is just looks brilliant. And World War Z, Zombies. There's Monsters University from Pixar and Lone Ranger, Pacific Rim, and that's going to be a big ILM show. So it's a huge summer.
Yeah, I've got to say... I'm really looking forward to... I've seen Trek, of course, because it's opened here. I'm really looking forward to... because of the Nolan influence, I'll admit it, Man of Steel. I'm okay with that. I can admit that. And if that turns out to be another Iron Man... Dark Knight.
Freudian Matt. Slip.
Oh.
Okay. Mr. Wallen, today is the first day of what's left of the rest of your life. I'll see you later. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next time. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com.